Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Well, good evening. This is John McMullen, welcoming you to the 75th edition of the John Mack Radio Show. My most recent column for the Westchester Guardian, visit the website, www.westchesterguardian.com. It is the 149th column in the Creative Disruption series. I hope you'll read the columns, enjoy them, and if the need be, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. John Mack is JohnMack, and that's johnmack13@gmail.com. You'll find links to the previous radio shows and to my online daily and free newspaper at my web home. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, www.johnmack13.com. And now to this show. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. I do hold the online participation of callers to near the conclusion of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is author, blogger, and professor of public policy, Dr. Oren M. Levin-Woolman. I first met Oren, if Oren is the correct word, when I read a column of his on income inequality in the aforementioned Western Guardian, where, as I just mentioned, I'm a regular columnist. Since then, I've looked for each new Levin-Woolman column there and at the Yonkers Tribune, not only because we tend to agree on economic policy, but also for the clarity of his writing and the learned foundation for the piece. He has been a prolific writer of books, articles, and academic journals, and has been the guest on local and national radio and television shows. We'll explore all of Oren's interesting life tonight on the John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Oren.
Good evening.
So let's start at the beginning. Where'd you grow up and go to early school?
How early do you want to know?
Oh, all the way back. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and you know, I went to a variety of different schools, mostly private, and then I ended up at Kiva Hebrew Academy for high school, which is sort of a small day school in suburban Philadelphia, Lower Merion, Pennsylvania, or was in Lower Merion, Pennsylvania before. The name was changed to Jack Barak Academy, and they moved to Bryn Mawr.
My wife's from Philadelphia, the Greater Northeast, Mayfair.
My wife's from the Northeast, too.
Okay. Then where'd you go to high school?
I went to Kiva Hebrew Academy, Lower
Merion. Oh, okay. And how old were you when you first developed an interest in politics and economics?
Well, I sort of grew up with an interest in politics. My mother used to talk politics all the time. Her father was, believe it or not, while a strong supporter of Franklin Roosevelt, he was also a person who voted for Norman Thomas 3 times. So that was always a lot of talk, discussion of politics in the house growing up.
And tell us about your college years and your aspirations while there.
Well, I went to Temple University. I majored in history. I spent 1 year at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, Israel. I graduated in 1982, and then I took a year off, and then I went back to Temple for a master's in urban studies. I thought maybe I'd become an urban planner, but some of the faculty appeared to have different plans for me, so I discovered later on they sort of steered me towards the PhD program, or one of the PhD programs, I should say. So I chose political science. So I took a PhD in political science in the late 80s.
And what was the subject of your doctoral dissertation?
The subject was plant closure regulation liberalism. So I was asking the question at the time, why can't liberal political philosophy, which has regulated so much in the past, you know, going all the way back to the early 1900s, why was it unable to find an effective response to plant closings, which seemed to be occurring, or widespread occurrence during the 70s and 80s? And the proposals that were actually being offered at the time, there had been some proposals introduced, co-introduced by then-Senator Walter Mondale at the time, had initially called for something like, you know, 60 days at least notification of intent to close a plant, compensation to workers who would in fact lose their jobs to the tune of something like, you know, 1 week's pay for every year they had been on the job. And in some cases, the legislation was calling for these companies to actually compensate the communities for the loss of their tax base. And when you think about it, those proposals were non-starters. There was no way they were ever going to go anywhere. And ultimately what did occur was in 1989 they did pass a law, but it was a very minimal piece of legislation, just calling for 60 days notification.
And was that a federal law, or was it a...
That was a federal law. Various states and localities had attempted, had thought about legislation in the past, but they realized, particularly at the local level, a restriction on plant closure is effectively a restriction on plant openings. So you might be hurting the prospects of attracting new investment to your community.
Now, does that only apply to plants, or would it also apply to national chains, like the Radio Shack, for instance?
It wasn't clear at the time whether it would apply to national chains. It basically would apply to companies with a certain threshold number of employees at the time. I don't recall at this point what it is, but at least 50 employees or more. Now, whether, you know, each chain store, like a Radio Shack, which has probably, you know, about 5-10 employees at the time, whether that would necessarily fall under that rubric is not entirely clear.
I was in the Radio Shack just yesterday that was closing, and the person there, they were selling off the inventory, said that he wasn't entitled to severance. He wasn't getting severance, and he'd been there for 7 years. I thought that that severance was definitely the law in New York State, that you were entitled to at least 2 weeks of, you know, going out the door. Is that not the case?
I don't know what the laws in New York with regard to severance. Certainly there was no severance that was provided for in the plant closing bill that was actually passed. So all it called for was notification, 60 days notification. And the idea was that if you give you 60 days notification, then you have some time to plan for the closure, to get your affairs in order.
Or to find a job, I hope. Yeah.
Right, to find a job. But, of course, in this kind of economy, that doesn't mean a whole lot.
Some of the terms of your various specialties may not be familiar to our listeners. For instance, is political economy a combination of political science and economics?
It is. As I write about these issues, it's usually what I define it. It's basically covering economic policy issues through the lenses of a political scientist. But political economy does have different meanings for different people. Some political scientists actually define political economy as the use of economic tools for the understanding of political phenomena, like, you know, using economic tools to understand voting behavior, that kind of thing.
Okay. What are wage contours? I wasn't familiar with that term. I saw in your...
A wage contour is not the most developed term around. It was actually developed by somebody named John Dunlop, who was a Harvard economist and actually served as Gerald Ford's Secretary of Labor in the mid-70s. And he basically developed this concept of a contour, which would refer to a set of wages around what he called a reference point. And, you know, the reference point could be say, the prevailing wage of a particular occupation or the prevailing wage of, or the average wage of a particular industry. And I've used it to sort of define, to talk about the minimum wage as a reference point for, say, the low-wage economy. And then what I've defined contours as sort of an interval. So in one book, what I did was I looked at 46 years worth of data where I actually created 10 contours. So I started with the statutory minimum wage in each year, and I added 25% to that. That would create the first contour. Then the second contour, basically an interval, would be the next 25% until I reached the level of 10 contours. And what I discovered was in each of those contours, in each of those years when the minimum wage was actually raised, the statutory minimum wage, the median wage in each of those contours also increased. And in years when the minimum wage was not increased, the median wage in those years stayed flat. And so by the time you reach the 10th contour, the median wage, you're already talking, at least in 2008, you were talking about an income of about $100,000. So that suggested to me, at least, that the minimum wage actually has middle-class benefits.
You know, and it's interesting when you're mentioning setting up various statistical analysis that there's so much more and more can be done now with this phenomenon that we call big data. It would seem that we've got, within the next 5 years, we'll have so much greater analysis tools. Most of your writing focuses on labor issues, the aforementioned plant closing, wages. What caused you to focus on that aspect of public policy and political economy?
Well, I mean, I guess I sort of fell into it to a large extent. I mean, again, I did the dissertation on plant closure. So that was my foray into economic policy. And then, you know, at some point I found myself at the Levy Economics Institute at Bard College for about 6 years. And then I was looking at issues like EITC, earned income tax credit. Then I became interested in the minimum wage, or they became interested in the minimum wage for me. So I started focusing on that. And then when I left the Levy Economics Institute, I had done a consulting project for public-private ventures, originally in Philadelphia and then with an office in New York. They've since closed because they couldn't no longer receive funding. But I did a project where I looked at income inequality in New York City in that 2000-2001. Then I had an endowed chair at New Jersey City University, where I decided to start look at the issue of the living wage. When I finally came to the Metropolitan College in New York, I sort of decided that I had written two books on wage policy, the living wage and the minimum wage earlier. So now it was time to write a third book, completing what I would call a trilogy, which I call Wage Policy, Income Distribution, and Democratic Theory.
And that came out in 2011,
yeah,
I think.
2011.
Oh, I do mention Bard. My wife adjuncted there in the graduate school teaching statistics a number of years ago. Tell us about your time there. Did you live in the area there? It's rather cold in the winter, I know.
I lived there for, for 2 years. I was commuting from Bard to Pennsylvania. I was living in Yardley, Pennsylvania for the first 2 years that I was there. I had an apartment in Germantown, New York, which I stayed in during the week. And then we moved to Poughkeepsie, New York, where we sojourned for about 3 years. And then after 3 years, for a variety of reasons, we moved to the lower Hudson Valley, Rockland County, where we are now.
The fellow that I knew, unfortunately, I can't think of his name, had a chair of political science there. He was a writer friend. Tell us about your time at the New Jersey City University.
It was only 2 years, actually, that I guess I held the first and only endowed chair at New Jersey State University. And then Governor McGreevy was elected, and he decided he wanted to cut the budget, and he eliminated all endowed chairs throughout the state of New Jersey. So that was
And then that brought you to Metropolitan College?
I came to Metropolitan College, yes.
I know that it's difficult to put the complexities of the issues you write about in depth in short radio time, but let's give a little shot. You have thought about and written extensively on wage policies, the minimum wage, the living wage, the aforementioned wage contours, unemployment insurance, and so on. Mentioning finally the impact the wage policy may have on civic participation. Would you take time to explain that background and take us down the path to civic participation?
Well, my thesis has been that a wage policy, one, fits with democratic theory. And to the extent that it, one, enables people to develop their capabilities, it enables them to be more self-sufficient, it enhances their autonomy, that becomes an essential ingredient to democratic governance. You can't really have responsible citizens if, in fact, they aren't autonomous. So that's part of the argument I was trying to make in wage policy and distribution and democratic theory, that a wage policy of sorts, I was really asking the initial question, is it compatible with democratic theory? And I was basically arguing to the extent that we could show that it really is middle class, would benefit the middle class, that it's also in line with democratic theory. That having been said, then I did a study where I looked at the issue of civic participation. Who was more likely to be involved, engaged in civic activity? People who come to meetings, people who voting is the most nominal form of civic participation, but who gets involved with their civic organizations, church groups, schools, this kind of thing. And it turns out, well, people whose incomes are over $100,000 are much more likely to be civically engaged than people coming from households where income is below $30,000. And even as you move from below $30,000 to, say, between $30,000 and $60,000, the level of civic engagement increases exponentially. So there's something to be said that people with higher incomes, at least they have more leisure time to devote to these kinds of activities, but they also may also have more of a self-interest. They certainly see that being engaged can serve their economic interest to a certain extent.
One of the things constantly raised by Democrats, particularly people like Thomas Frank, who have written about it, is why do people throughout dying manufacturing areas continue to vote against what the Democratic theory see as their own interests, Ohio going Republican and Iowa and places like this that have been gutted by unemployment. Why do you, talking about civic participation, wouldn't you think people who are losing jobs and everything would tend to be more liberal to vote for protection for the workers rather than a cutting of unemployment and food stamps and the like?
Intuitively, you would think that'd be the case. But the truth of the matter is, what we're finding is that one of the institutions that got people out to vote in the first place and got them involved in these communal affairs were the unions. Unions, at a minimum, they delivered their members to vote. Well, union membership has declined considerably over the last three decades. And without that basic institution in place, you don't really have as much participation.
One of my major interests is the impact that technological innovation has on employment, the facilitation of offshoring through the power of telecommunications, elimination of jobs through automation, robotics, and the use of artificial intelligent modules, as well as the total disruption of industries such as music and film photography through digital innovation. As a technologist, I never want to stifle innovation, but how do we deal with this continuing impact on employment?
I don't think there's any way to stop innovation, nor should we even be trying to stop innovation. But I think we do have to recognize the fact that in an economy, a dynamic economy, which as Joseph Schumpeter once described as creative destruction, creative destruction, while it may be the march of progress, it is also leaves in its wake a lot of destruction, which can take 50 to 100 years to come out of. So what we have to do is we have to sort of ask ourselves, well, is there a way we can help those who are left behind? Many of those who are left behind are now what we would call low-skilled workers. And low-skilled workers today are no different than factory workers were in the early 1900s. They were that generation's low-skilled workers. But what gave them, or the perception that they were skilled, and what gave them some dignity was the fact that the unions basically offered them dignity. The unions created the middle class. So what we really need now is for labor market institutions to be in place that would in turn offer these low-skilled workers that we have now some sense of dignity to create a middle class out of these workers as well.
But we also have middle-income and upper-income jobs. For instance, all the people that went out of Kodak because of digital photography, or all of the people who went out of Tower Records or bought as booksellers, or all of the middle managers whose jobs are being taken away by artificial intelligence modules. Now, in many cases, they're either too old, or they don't have the new skills to have anywhere near the income level that they have. How do we handle them?
That's a tougher nut to solve. But if you look at those who are actually unemployed, and if you look at the figures for say long-term unemployment, you will find that the group that's most likely to be long-term unemployed are still those who have no more than a high school education.
One of the problems.
Higher levels start doing better.
One of the problems that I'm sure that you have seen it is that successful companies through automation have been able to make the customer or the consumer part of the process. So when we pay our bills to Con Edison or to other people online, there are no longer people at the utility opening the envelopes and keying things in or bringing the checks to the bank. And in many cases, these people are either too old, too uneducated, or don't, in some cases, have the intelligence to be trained to high-level jobs. How do we handle them?
In some cases, you're going to have to talk about massive retraining or programs that will do that. In other cases, if what they're going to be left with are low-skilled, low-paying jobs, then we have to find ways to give dignity to that form of work.
From my understanding of economic history, it seems to me that this is the first economic revolution that has replaced more jobs with many less jobs. The high-tech jobs that lead to the lower-paying jobs being eliminated or dumbed down also feeds right into another issue that you've written extensively on, income inequality. This term is all over the press, but there seems to be little real explanation for its causes, impact on society, and possible solutions. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Well, it seems as though the solution that's bandied about by a lot of politicians, particularly in the Democratic Party these days, is we need to reattract manufacturing back to this country. Maybe that that would help restore the middle class. That having been said, I'm not convinced that manufacturing alone will restore the middle class. What will restore the middle class are institutions that serve to bolster the wages of the middle class, that would in fact raise the wages of those at the bottom. And we talk about income inequality. The reason why, it's not even so much if you have income inequality, there's always been income inequality. The issue is that the rate of growth in income inequality has accelerated over the last 2 to 3 decades. So that the gap between the top and the bottom has increased. What you want to do is you want the wages of those at the bottom to rise at a higher rate relative to the wages of those at the top. If that occurs, income inequality will in fact be less. The proposals that are often bandied about focus on this idea, well, if we simply tax the rich more, then income inequality will be reduced. Well, that is true to the extent that income inequality is defined as after-tax income, but it doesn't solve the problem of those at the bottom not earning higher wages. That's the real problem we have right now.
When technology wipes out jobs, the remaining jobs tend to be dumbed down, whereas the people that have put the technology in tend to get huge increases in their compensation. Obviously, the ones on the top, like in Wall Street, tend to do very, very well. It seems to constantly have that the widening of the gap. Now, I haven't seen many recommendations to how we close the gap, other than, as you mentioned, taxing the high end people to provide higher minimum wage and other things at the low end. Have there been other more creative solutions bandied around, or are we kind of stuck in a, we ought to do this and we won't be able to do it?
We're stuck in the same politics we've been stuck in for quite some time now. I'm not even suggesting we tax the people, those at the rooftop. I'm suggesting we strengthen our institutions that bolster the wages from the bottom up. And my argument about wage contours is that if you have a higher minimum wage and it's indexed to inflation, that's going to ripple through the wage distribution. It's going to affect the middle class in a positive fashion. That will help reduce income inequality. I think the solution really has to be in basically raising the focusing on wage inequality rather than broader income inequality. I think when you talk about income inequality and we're going to tax the rich and we're going to cut capital corporate taxes here and there, you're just offering a lot of political platitudes which ultimately go nowhere.
Should we be indexing the minimum wage to the cost of living, or to rise in productivity, or to something else that would make it automatic and take out this constant political fighting about it?
It should definitely be indexed to something. What it's indexed to is an open question. The CPI has been one proposal. Because when inflation increases, then so too is the minimum wage. But perhaps a better way to index it might be to some kind of productivity index. So when productivity increases, then you can assume that rising wages are reflected in that productivity increase. So if you then index the minimum wage to that, it would not take a bite out of profits. So that would be a positive thing. And the value of indexing the minimum wage to at least something is that it's predictable. Everybody knows they can expect that the minimum wage is going to go up by 1% or 2% a year. It's not this, when that we finally passed law after, 15 years of inaction, and now we're going to see a 25% bite in the wage bill. That's a shock for a lot of employers, and you wouldn't have that shock anymore. And yeah, it would eliminate the political battle lines.
The bringing back of manufacturing, by the way, it doesn't seem to me to be possible unless it's through new plants being built and new other things, so we can rival foreign countries in a deficiency. Now, we are talking about, and people have written about nanotechnology, manufacturing, and everything like this, but it would seem to me that would take a good while to turn things around. Do you feel that we can we can rapidly bring manufacturing back to the United States?
I don't see that as a terribly likely prospect. The problem is a lot of these manufacturing companies have left this country because wage rates are so much lower elsewhere. And, you know, the problem is we need higher wages in this country. And that's part of the reason why we don't have a middle class. So these companies have left. They've taken their good-paying jobs with them. They've left in their wake workers who are then forced to take jobs in the service sector, which is paying considerably less. But at the same time, they also some of these companies do find that there's no that the workers that they find in these third world countries really aren't capable of doing the job. So in some cases, some of them do actually come back, but they're looking for locations in the country where they don't have to deal with unions. So, I mean, I think we need to find some way to make it palatable for them to come back. But at the same time, we also have to recognize the fact that we have an aging infrastructure which was not destroyed in a world war, which was not rebuilt with a massive infusion of capital through a Marshall Plan. And that's part of why we're at a disadvantage when it comes to our competitive ability vis-a-vis the Japanese, for instance,
or even many of the people who talk about the productivity of the Germans and the Japanese and the success of Volkswagen and Toyota never seem to bring up that we bombed their factory to smithereens and then we rebuilt them when we weren't rebuilding our own. It's amazing that we don't even talk about the history there and why that Ford and General Motors didn't do the same thing while rebuilding of the foreign factories. The fixation on lowest possible consumer prices that led by Walmart has led to offshoring, layoffs, and low wages. And the American taxpayer, through the financing of the food stamps and other benefits to Walmart workers, is actually subsidizing the company's low wage prices. And unemployment and low wages, they're drawing up consumer buying power. Why don't we, as a voting population, get this?
I don't think we as a voting population quite understand the connections and how companies like Walmart are insidiously destroying the middle class. What Walmart does is it basically says to suppliers like Rubbermaid, if you want our business, and they become one of the largest purchasers of, say, Rubbermaid goods. They say, if you want our business, we want you to cut your wage costs by 20%. In which case, Rubbermaid then finds it has to reduce wages or fire workers or something in order to maintain that contract. That's the largest contract they have, and they can't do without it. And they go to the mat next year and say, now we want you to cut it by another 10%. And this goes on and on. And they do this with every other supplier. All this is basically leading to having manufacturers say, well, I can't produce these goods in this country anymore. I really do have to go offshore in order to reduce the cost so I can have this contract. Meanwhile, Walmart comes back and says, but we're offering cheap goods to our consumers who are benefiting from this. The problem is when you pay your workers such low wages, we the taxpayers are subsidizing low-wage work through a variety of different public supports, food stamps, for example. And what we're really doing is we're subsidizing their profits.
And we're also, it would seem to me that some people should realize that at some point these consumers who are benefiting from the low prices, they become the unemployed workers who can't buy the things. I mean, if there's no consumer buying power, who's going to buy all this stuff? Who's going to buy the more expensive stuff? Who's going to buy the iPads and the Android devices and the big television sets if the middle class and the lower class has no buying power?
Well, that's the conundrum. Of course, Walmart will come along and say, well, but we're offering the ability to buy that big screen TV for a lot less money than you would have been able to purchase it 25 years ago, and you know, in some mom and pop TV store. Now, I don't know how true that is. I mean, I suppose yes, it's true. You can now get a flat screen TV for $100, but still, the middle class is dwindling, and people forget that people like Henry Ford offered to pay a higher wage, a $5 a day minimum to his workers, because he claimed that it was necessary in order to have a middle class. So this middle class would then be able to go and purchase his cars. Everybody, his competitors, thought he was nuts. They said, you're crazy. You'll go out of business. There's no way you can support that kind of minimum wage. But he insisted on doing it.
How do those of us who believe that we have major unaddressed economic problems in the country work productively to turn things around, do you think?
I think that we have to have a new level of political discourse, which we really have not had. And all we have right now is, you know, one side calling the other side names, and no side seems to think it's important to sit down and work out some kind of compromise of the way politics was done, you know, 35, 40 years ago. That seems to be long past. Now the Democratic Party demonizes the Republican Party. The Republican Party demonizes the Democratic Party. And I've come to the conclusion that, it's sad to say, I'm not sure either party really cares about the unemployed.
Well, I remember, and I was totally wrong. I remember when I first started following politics, I thought that, gee, we have these Republican conservatives like Barry Gordon and John Tower. We have these Republican liberals like Jake Javits and Nelson Rockefeller. And we have the liberal Democrats like Hubert Humphrey, and we have the conservative Democrats, mainly the southern racists. Wouldn't it make more sense if all the liberals were in one party and all the conservatives in the other? But we have that now, and it's awful because they hate each other. And we've gerrymandered so many safe districts for either party in the country that it seems to me the only way that a new Republican can move along is to go to the right of the present guy, or a new Democrat can go to the left of the present Democrat, and it just seems to get more and more polarized.
Well, part of that's a function of the electoral system and the way we select candidates to run for national office, particularly at the presidential level. I mean, if you're going to have a system based on participatory caucuses and primaries starting in states like Iowa and then New Hampshire, you know, these are states which don't really carry that many delegates to begin with. And yet, all the attention's there. So it basically creates this dynamic whereby, you know, unless you win one of these states, you don't get the media attention, you don't get the donations that you expected to get, and you don't have the momentum you need going into the bigger states. So the only and what Iowa and New Hampshire does on both sides of the aisle is they select for very liberal and very conservative, respectively, for the Democratic and Republican parties. So the only way to fix that problem is probably to have some kind of national primary day.
So I was really talking about the congressional elections, where we have the safe districts, and we have and more than more, it's the extremists, particularly in the Republican Party, who seem to be winning the primaries, then going off. Do you see the benefit to such movements as Occupy, or do they have some say turn off too many people?
If they could sustain themselves, maybe there's some benefit, but I'm not sure Occupy Wall Street really had a tact to get it to begin with from the very get-go. I think what really has to happen, and this is part of the reason why income inequality is so dangerous to democratic governance, you know, the reason why income inequality is a problem is because our Congress, regardless of which party holds power, is more responsive to those who are affluent, those who contribute, make the largest contributions to their political campaigns. And the only way you're going to solve that problem is with some kind of campaign finance reform. So that's already one of the issues that has to be addressed. But we've already had, in effect, Citizens United basically invalidated a part of McCain-Feingold. So, you know, and even that was limited in its ability to really address the problem.
Yeah, Occupy. I went down to some of the Occupy Wall Street things, and it was so demonized in the press, particularly the New York Post, about all of these terrible things that were going on. And I saw none of it. I saw middle-aged people there running libraries, handing out books. I saw bright college kids. I was very impressed with it. As far as the financing, it seems to me that money has become so important, and we have the 2-year terms for representatives. I don't see how that without extending those terms that we can ever stop these people getting elected and 20 minutes later going back to raise money for the next election. Do you have any comments on how we get around that?
Maybe public financing of campaigns would be a way to start. This is the system that the framers created. They debated the whole question of what the length of term should be for members of the House of Representatives. And one group said 1 year. One group said 3 years. 2 years became the compromise. 1 year, they figured they'd be closer to the people, but they'd be always be constantly running for re-election. 3 years, they'd be a little too far removed from the public. And 2 years, well, you see what the problem is. You know, they're elected, but shortly after they take office, they are trying to raise money for their next campaign. The theory is, well, they at least have a year before they actually have to start actively campaigning for re-election.
Do you have any hope for campaign of to finance reform? Public financing, for instance?
I don't at the moment. As long as you have a Supreme Court that takes the view that contributions, money contributions, is a legitimate form of speech, even though it gives certain groups more speech than others, I don't see that changing. Now, this Citizens United is not a new idea. It really goes back to Buckley versus Vallejo in 1976, where the Supreme Court basically ruled that. So this wasn't a new decision by any stretch of the imagination. It simply expanded, and it basically overturned a lot of electoral reforms that had been passed over the years. Those initial reforms, you know, going back to the 70s, basically made it illegal for corporations and labor unions to contribute to campaigns. Now, corporations and labor unions can contribute to campaigns. They can contribute large sums of money, and they can, in fact, run their own independent campaigns. Now, that becomes a problem. I think one possibility for removing interest groups from politics altogether might be a simpler tax code. If you simply eliminated all the loopholes and all the deductions, which a lot of interest groups sort of, you know, congregate around trying to get their wares, I think you'd remove a lot of politics from that we see right now. So if you have a progressive flat tax rate system, you know, 3 or 4 progressive tax rates with, you know, no deductions, I think a lot of these interest groups would be gone.
No one seems to remember, though, how progressive the tax rates were during the Eisenhower years, with the very high tax rates at the end. When that was that and the rest of the post World War II was some of the great boom towns in the United States. Now what we talk about is the high tax rates put a cap on the economy. Well, it wasn't that way in the 50s and 60s.
But at the same time, you also had a lot of loopholes, and while the effective marginal tax rate may have been up to 90% in the 1950s, nobody was ever paying a 90% marginal tax rate. So you had enough deductions where effectively the top rate was 50%. And very few people were earning above, say, $10,000 that would push them into that higher rate. Now with inflation the way it hasn't been adjusted, you haven't adjusted the tax code as such, at least you'd see a lot more people paying higher taxes.
One of my heroes at the time, Ted Williams, was paying in the 90%. I remember them writing about it in sports magazines. In 1996, you wrote a book, Reconceiving Liberalism. Was there much in that book almost 20 years ago that is still relevant today, or would you have to totally rewrite the book to have the same effect, do you think?
I might have to rewrite the book. At the time, I was sort of trying to argue that for a liberalism that wasn't too far to the left, as it seems to be today, a liberalism that sort of focused on personal responsibility as well as civil rights, civil liberties. This idea, a liberalism that basically valued, say, work and policies that promoted work as opposed to entitlement. That was the kind of liberalism I was talking about. And I was kind of trying to reread some of the original sources of liberalism, particularly, say, John Locke, who in many respects has been misinterpreted, being the patron saint of individualism and private property rights at the expense of community. But the truth is that's not really what John Locke was all about. John Locke, if you read his Second Treatise of Government and read alongside his essay concerning human understanding, and then his essay on toleration, you really get a whole different picture of John Locke. But Locke, in many respects, was talking about how individuals really can't survive without a community around them. Their individualism is, in fact, defined by the communities in which they live. And that was Locke's contribution, which I think has been grossly misunderstood.
We have this apparently split or two wings of Democratic Party now. The one that the more populist groups referred to as the Wall Street wing, which they identify Hillary Clinton with, and the more populist, the wing of Elizabeth Warren, of Bernie Sanders. What do you see the future of liberalism as we move through the election process? Where is it going to come from, do you think?
I don't know. I don't think the Elizabeth Warren and the Bernie Sanders wing, if you even call it that, what we call the more leftist group, is necessarily, I should say, populist group, is really a proper definition of liberalism. I think liberalism sort of has to be redefined as to what it meant in the 1930s, perhaps. And to a certain extent, Bill Clinton was trying to do that. He was the centrist Democrat. People forget he came from the DLC. In the early 90s, and he was supposed to sort of bring back a level of conservatism to the Democratic Party. That's what made it so appealing in the early 90s. It was the Republicans that did their best to redefine him as the leftist liberal, which he really wasn't. And I don't know, to a certain extent, I think Hillary has always been more to the left than her husband was. And of course, if she gets the nomination, the Republican Party will do exactly the same thing. They'll redefine her as some kind of leftist, or even more left than Barack Obama, if that's possible. So that's what we're going to see. I don't think the nature of American politics is going to improve anytime soon.
Do you see any? Do you see Jeb Bush as being able to hold off to Ted Cruz's and the other people and coming across as a more moderate Republican than the libertarian or the extreme right of the Republican Party?
Possibly. The only problem is people may feel, well, the three bushes is too much. So that's your difficulty there. But I think the other problem is he probably suffers from the same problems that the Romney suffered from. You know, here's a centrist Republican who would like to take the party in a centrist direction, and in order to get the nomination, he's going to have to taxi to the right in order to get that nomination. So he has to appeal to those who would support Cruz, the Tea Party types, those who are anti-immigration and the whole bit. And then he's going to have to taxi to the middle, or certainly the left where he was in the primaries, in order to win a general election, in which case people will accuse him. Well, what do you stand for?
Do you see any moderate Democrats or centrist Democrats that have the chance?
Everybody has a chance that they can raise enough money and have an appeal to the voting public. But again, as long as you have a selection process which begins in Iowa and goes through New Hampshire and takes 6 months to sort out who the nominee is going to be, you're always going to self-select for the most liberal on the Democratic side and the most conservative on the Republican side. And the only solution to that, I think, is to have a national primary day.
But when you've had Huckabee win in Iowa, he disappeared shortly thereafter. I mean, so there have been some people who have come out of Iowa who haven't been, who have just disappeared because they were too right for the Republicans.
It's not 100%, but they tend to be, you know, they find that they have to say things in order to appeal to people, but perhaps less so on the Republican side than it is on the Democratic Party side.
We've covered a lot of the bases in exploring your productive life. What's next for you? More books in the hopper, or do you have any of interest in politics for yourself, or?
I don't see myself running for office. I certainly don't have $2 million in my back pocket to run for office, so I don't see that in my future. Probably some more books. I'm currently working on a book on the minimum wage as a reference book, and I'd sort of like to do some more on the issue of civic participation and how it may benefit from some kind of wage policy, which will lead to more equitable distribution of wages and on a more comparative level in the United States versus European countries.
You've taught at a fairly elite college at Bard, and you're teaching at a community college now. How do you find the differences in the students, and how do you find your experience there?
Well, I mean, students are students on one level, and of course we have greater diversity of students. I'm teaching graduate students, so it's not really a community college; it's a private college.
Okay.
But it's the mission is to sort of serve those who have been disadvantaged historically. So, you know, in some cases they need a little bit more help, but they certainly, in some cases, it's sort of rewarding to teach those who don't necessarily have a sense of entitlement, but they really need to work hard, and they want to make something of themselves.
I had that experience. I was at Monroe College in the Bronx for 12 years, and it's a privately owned college, and mainly of the people there were people who, in my judgment, had been failed by New York City public schools, bright people from poor neighborhoods, and or from families that didn't push education. They went out into the workforce, and they realized that they needed more, and they came back to school. Some of them, it was 97% minorities. Some of them had never been out of the New York metropolitan area, and I was able to place about 100 with IBM all over the country in Dallas and in Raleigh, and they really asked, is that going to be on the test? It was all give me more. Very impressive, but they were not prepared. But New York city schools. They were not able to hang sentences together. They didn't realize that every sentence needed a verb. They had double negatives in their speech, and I never could have gotten out of high school like that, you know. And it was wonderful to see their push, but it was also very painful to see what they had been allowed to pass through New York public schools with. Have you found much of that?
I found some of that. I find a little bit less of it because most of my students tend to be graduate students. So. But to be honest, I've also found, you know, teaching at the elite level, students who, one, don't do the readings. Two, they feel they don't have to do the readings. Three, a deadline is just a mere suggestion, and, you know, they don't really care. I mean, after all, daddy's going to support them no matter what. I remember a time when I was looking out my office window, you know, and to leave the economics institute, and there's a field behind me, and a helicopter lands. The helicopter lands, and apparently were people from the admissions office came to greet this person who got off the helicopter. Well, apparently, I guess it was somebody coming for an interview. Their parents, probably corporate types in Manhattan, flew their kid, their son or daughter, to the school for an interview, and there was the admissions office to greet them. 45 minutes later, then they were escorted back onto the helicopter, and the helicopter whisked that person away. What more can you say?
It's a whole different life. Yeah, I adjunct SUNY Purchase now, and it's an interesting school. That is mainly the art school of the state university. But I do have journalism students. I do have science students. But the thing that I constantly try to get them is the changing world. They keep having to be looking at the school because so many jobs are changing so dramatically, or they're going away. So it's and they seem to respond. I just hope they do. So, well, what else would you like our audience to know about Orrin Levin Wolman?
Well, I'm just trying to make a difference in the public policy debate, and hopefully, what I'm really trying to make a case for is that more public policy should be focused on the middle class, and I'm looking for ways that the minimum wage can be used as a policy that benefits the middle class.
Well, thank you very, very much for your time, Orrin. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
And some commercial information. My column appears weekly in the Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, critic John Simon, historian Daniel Pipes, and others. The Westchester Guardian is available in print format and online at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at open.salon.com/blogs/JohnMack13. The blog, by the way, is available automatically on Kindle, so at an exorbitant cost of 99 cents per month. And those who sign up right now will even have the link to this show permanently on their Kindles. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose after the Mets win, put it in a book. Go to my website, www.johnmack13.com, to URLs for previous shows, schedule of upcoming shows, and the path to the GoFundMe location to keep this show going. Tune in next week for the 76th show in the series. Until then, as they say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, steady, Silver. Steady, steady. Steady, Silver. Come here, Silver. Come here. Keep moving, Tonto.